I want to finish the series that I started last week on not being easily provoked. And if you remember last week, we talked about the seriousness of being easily provoked, which violates one of the characteristics of charity, which is the highest of the Christian virtues. And we also talked about how it's always wrong to be easily provoked. So there's never a time where we can justifiably say, I was provoked easily, but I had good reason for it. You could be provoked, as we talked about. It's not always wrong to be provoked or to be angry, but to be soon angry or to be easily provoked is always wrong. What I want to do today is I want to give you some of the reasons why we find ourselves being easily provoked. I could have just left it off last week with just telling you, okay, it's wrong, don't do it anymore. But what I wanted to show you, and I wanted to try to, it was my own curiosity, is to find out why do people become easily provoked? What are the things that causes us to do that? Because you ever find yourself getting irritated, and then you step back and you ask yourself, now why did I get irritated about that? What was the big deal? It's just most of the time, when we get irritated about something, it's a minor little thing. It's not even a big deal. And you think, okay, why do I do that? And then I say, I'm not going to do that anymore. And then I do it again. I say, why do I do that? So I just got thinking, okay, why does this happen to us? And what I want to show you are the underlying causes of being easily provoked. The ones that I've found, anyway. I found 7 of them. That would be a good number. It's the number of completeness. Maybe there's 8 or 10 or 20. I don't know. But I've found 7 of them in the Bible. And I'll get to them in just a second, but just to review one thing that we covered last time, and that is hasty anger rests in the bosom of fools. If you turn to Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 9, I just want to remind you that whenever you're being easily provoked, you are acting like a fool. Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 9. And when I say you, I can substitute we, when I'm talking about all of us here. Ecclesiastes 7, 9, Solomon says, be not hasty in thy spirit to be angry, for anger resteth in the bosom of fools. Now the anger there under consideration is hasty anger, or being soon angry. So anger itself doesn't always necessarily rest in the bosom of fools, because, or let me put it this way, you don't have to be a fool to have anger in your bosom, because Jesus Christ was angry, and he certainly was no fool. But to be hasty to be angry, that is the type of anger that resteth in the bosom of fools. Now, it would be easy to understand why a person could be provoked by something catastrophic, some big event, something happens, some guy walks up and just clocks you right across the face and then tries to pummel your nose into your brain or something. Well, yeah, you might be okay to be angry in that circumstance, right? That wouldn't be being easily provoked. But what about maybe a major incident where you think, this might be justifiable. Maybe some guy just calls you a name, right, and calls you a really bad name or something, and you feel this anger swelling up in you, and you want to lash back at him. Well, that wouldn't be right either. Even under the greatest provocations, we're still not justified in being easily provoked. Let me show you. In Ecclesiastes 5 and verse 8, Solomon tells us, that not only are we not to be easily provoked when we see perversions of justice out there, but we're not even supposed to worry about it or care about it. That's what he says. Ecclesiastes 5 and verse 8. He says, if thou seest the oppression of the poor and violent perverting of judgment and justice in a province. In other words, like when you turn on the evening news. We see that all the time, right? The oppression of the poor by governments and by corporations, and the violent perverting of judgment and justice. You see, the Justice Department, they should put a little SIC underneath or behind justice. The sick means, you know, it was spelled wrong and you're just copying it as it was put there, right? Justice should be spelled just us these days. There is not much justice that goes on. Whenever the Supreme Court rules that sodomites can marry, and that especially that states must honor this and give them marriage certificates, that is not justice prevailing by any stretch. It's the violent perverting of judgment and justice in a province. Now we would see things like that and we want to be soon angry. We want to be easily provoked, right? But what does Solomon say? Marvel not at the matter. Don't even be astonished by this, Solomon says. That's what it means to marvel. That's why whenever the Supreme Court case happened there, where they legalized the sodomite marriage, I wasn't shocked or surprised by that. I mean, anybody that's been paying attention for the last decade probably saw it coming anyway. I'm not saying I was not happy about it, but I didn't marvel at it and just like fall on my face and think, how did this happen? No, I mean, read Romans chapter 1. That's how it happened. Started back in the 1800s whenever they started teaching evolution. And then it goes to moral debauchery. Marvel not at the matter. For he that is higher than the highest regardeth, and there be higher than they. You say, well, who's higher than the Supreme Court justices? The Lord Jesus Christ. That's who's higher. Marvel not at the matter. God regards, he's higher than the highest. He sees all these things, and he won't let it go forever. One of these days, the cup of their iniquity is going to be full, and he's going to have had enough, and he will judge. We got to let it up to him. We don't need to be getting soon angry about these things. Jesus would have been our quintessential example of not being easily provoked under intense provocation. I'm going to show you three different times in the trial of Jesus Christ before they crucified him where he was intensely provoked three times and he did not allow himself to be provoked. Look at Matthew 26, 59 through 68. We should always go to the Lord Jesus Christ as our example. We're supposed to be followers of Christ. That's why we're called Christians, right? So we look at how Jesus handled himself and we think, could I keep myself back from being angry and irritated when somebody is spitting in my face? When somebody's calling me names, blaspheming me, especially if you were the Son of God. Imagine that. And yet he did it. Matthew 26, 59 through 68. It says, now the chief priests and elders and all the council sought false witness against Jesus to put him to death, but found none. Yea, though many false witnesses came, yet found they none. At the last came two false witnesses and said, this fellow said, I am able to destroy the temple of God and build it in 3 days. And the priest arose and said unto him, answerest thou nothing? What is it which these witness against thee? Put yourself in Jesus' shoes. Imagine you're on trial in a court and false witnesses get up and you know for a fact these guys are lying about you and they are not telling the truth. And they get up there and they say, I saw him do this, I saw him do that, and they are condemning you publicly. What would we normally want to do? You lying SOB, I did not do that, and you know it. He's lying. Get all in a huff, get all red in the face, right? But that's not what Jesus did. Even when he was falsely accused. Verse 63, but Jesus held his peace, and the high priest answered and said unto him, I adjure thee by the living God that thou tell us whether thou be the Christ, the Son of God. Jesus saith unto him, thou hast said. In other words, you said it, buddy. You're right, I am the Son of God, the Christ. Nevertheless, I say unto you, hereafter shall ye see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power and coming in the clouds of heaven. Then the high priest rent his clothes, saying, he hath spoken blasphemy. What further need have we of witnesses? Behold, now ye have heard his blasphemy. Now they're calling the truth coming out of his mouth blasphemy. They're saying he's blaspheming. What's the penalty for blasphemy under the law of Moses? Death. They're trying to set him up to kill him. What think ye? They answered and said, he's guilty of death. I told you. Verse 67. Then did they spit in his face and buffeted him, and others smote him with the palms of their hands, saying, prophesy unto us, thou Christ, who is it? Who is he that smote thee? Now they're making fun of him. Smack him in the face and say, okay, now prophesy, who was it? How many of us would have been provoked at that point? Probably all of us. But Jesus didn't. That was the first time. Look at Mark 15, 17 through 20. What I'm doing is I'm taking away your excuse. Because you're going to have an excuse whenever you get easily provoked and you're like, but this was justifiable. Okay, well, let's compare it with the standard. Did somebody spit in your face, smack you in the face, blaspheme your name, and set up false witnesses against you? If it was worse than that, okay, then you can make your argument that I was justifiably easily provoked. But if it's less than that, well, there's the standard. You shouldn't have been. Mark 15, 17 through 20. And they clothed him with purple and plaited a crown of thorns and put it about his head and began to salute him. Hail, King of the Jews. They're making fun of him again, trying to humiliate him. And they smote him on the head with a reed and did spit upon him and bowing their knees worshipped him. And when they had mocked him, they took off the purple from him and put his own clothes on him and led him out to crucify him. Not a word. Not a word. And Jesus could have truly said, oh, you wait, you're going to burn in hell for that. He could have said that and it would have been absolutely true. And yet he didn't. He didn't. Let's look at Matthew. Actually, I skipped one. Let's go back to Matthew. Matthew 27, 11 through 14. Matthew 27, 11 through 14. This is another time. And Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor asked him, saying, art thou the King of the Jews? Matthew 27, 11. And Jesus said unto him, thou sayest. And when he was accused of the chief priests and elders, he answered nothing. Then said Pilate unto him, hearest thou how many things they witness against thee? And he answered him to never a word, insomuch that the governor marveled greatly. This was an astonishing thing. Obviously, the governor had never seen such a thing. Normally, when somebody's brought before the governor and people stand up and start condemning him and mistreating him to this extent, they would be lashing back. He marveled. You know, I always pray and I tell you and tell myself that we ought to live in such a way that people might see that and then ask a question about us. Well, I'll tell you what. If you are not provoked in a situation when the average person would be, that will make people stop and think. They will. And they will admire that and they'll say, wow, that was amazing. That guy did not flip out. He did not start screaming, even when he was being provoked vehemently. That is a good witness right there. I don't ever read of Pilate becoming a Christian, but anyway, he did ask, what is truth? Jesus was ready to give an answer, right? Isn't that what we're supposed to be ready to do? Give an answer to every man that asketh us a reason of the hope that's within us with meekness and fear. So here you see three times Jesus was provoked, or men tried to provoke him three times. And yet, what do we read in 1 Peter 2 in verse 23? 1 Peter 2 in verse 23. First Peter 2:23, who, when he was reviled, reviled not again. When he suffered, he threatened not, but committed himself to him that judgeth righteously. The Son of God, to whom was given all power in heaven and in earth, committed it to his Father in heaven, who judgeth righteously. He was our model. As a man, he did that. He committed it to his Father. As God, he could have wiped those suckers out anytime he wanted to. But as a man, he committed it to God. He threatened not, and he didn't revile back in kind. We always want to get even, at least get even. I mean, getting even is usually not good enough. We want to up it a little bit. You know, they call me a name, I want to come up with a better one, right? That's not what Jesus did. He's our example that we should control our spirits even under the highest level of provocation. So there, I've taken your excuses away. There'll be no more excuses that he made me so mad I was justified. Tell it to Jesus. I don't think you're going to get very far. Okay, so there's some of the big things, big examples, and we could understand as men and women why people could be provoked under circumstances such as Jesus was in. But what about the little things? What about that? I mean, those are really the things that usually provoke us. Not many of us are usually in court of law with false witnesses and people smacking us in the face and spitting on us and things like that. Usually it's just, you know, your wife asking you to grab something out of a cupboard that's too high for her to reach when you're in the middle of something. It's something stupid like that, right? Normally that's what we get provoked about, right? It's usually trivial things. Just think about it. Think about all the things that you've been provoked in the last week. And how many of them were great big things where you could legitimately go to God and say, Lord, I think this one was justified. Probably none of them. It's probably all of them were like, that was so dumb. Why did I get angry or irritated about something as silly as that? Okay, so why do these things happen? Why do we get provoked? I'm going to give you 7 reasons. Number one is pride. Pride is the cardinal sin. It's the sin that brought Satan down. And it's ultimately would certainly be tied into the sin that brought Adam and Eve down. Didn't they see the fruit that it was desired to be, to make one wise and so on? So they wanted to be wise. They wanted to have what was not theirs to have. They thought too highly of themselves. That's it. It's just it. Pride is thinking too highly of ourselves. That's basically the definition of the word. You see, we get offended when somebody doesn't like our ideas. When they don't like our decisions and they think that they have a better one, then we get provoked. We feel ourselves getting angry. Because after all, I mean, I'm a pretty smart guy and I know what I'm doing. And why wouldn't you see it my way? And if I come up with an idea and you say, no, that's stupid, let's do it another way, you feel that anger. You feel that you want to be easily provoked, right? Let me give you a great example of this one back there in the scripture. In 2 Samuel 16 and verse 23. Now talk about being easily provoked. This guy here, his name was Ahithophel. I mean, he took being easily provoked to pretty much the highest level that you possibly can. I hope none of you get this provoked, or we're going to have a lot smaller church here. And it's not because of anything that I did. It's going to be what you did. 2 Samuel 16 and verse 23. Some of you who are acute Bible students probably know what I'm talking about. 2 Samuel 16, 23. It says, "In the council of Ahithophel, which he counseled in those days, was as if a man had inquired at the oracle of God. So was also the counsel of Ahithophel, both with David and with Absalom." Now you talk about a wise guy. This guy's counsel was as if we went to the word of God, to the prophet itself, and we got it straight out of the mouth of God. When this guy said something, you could pretty much bank on it. If he gave you advice, you better take it, because it is as good as gold. That might have fueled his pride a little bit, don't you think? If you're that wise, he probably thought pretty highly of himself. What do you think old Ahithophel would do if somebody didn't take his counsel? I'm going to show you what he did. Look at 2 Samuel 17 and verse 14. You see, Ahithophel, and I'm not going to go through the whole story, but he gave some really good counsel about how Absalom could have killed David. And it was good counsel. Well, the Lord was working in the background on David's behalf, and the Lord had them take the counsel of another guy named Hushai, I think it was. We'll get to that in just a second. Anyway, the Lord had him end up taking the bad counsel, and he saved David. But anyway, let's look at it here in 2 Samuel 17 and verse 14. It says, "And Absalom and all the men of Israel said, 'The counsel of Hushai, the Archite, is better than the counsel of Ahithophel.'" How did that make Ahithophel feel? When your counsel is as if the oracle of God, and they say, "Oh, this Hushai character, his counsel is better than Ahithophel." "For the Lord had appointed," here's why, "for the Lord had appointed to defeat the good counsel of Ahithophel to the intent that the Lord might bring evil upon Absalom." Now here's the thing. Ahithophel's counsel was good. The counsel that he gave was good. So imagine if you do have good ideas or good counsel, and then somebody says, no, that's dumb. We want to go with this, what this other guy says. Maybe you are even right, but you're still not justified in being easily provoked. Just keep it cool. Explain your reasons. If they want to take the other guy's dumb idea, just say, "Okay, I'm just letting you know this is probably not a good idea, and I will be here so you can come back and I'll help you pick up the pieces." That would have been the wise thing to do. But look at what Ahithophel does. Talk about being easily provoked. Verse 23, 2 Samuel 17, 23. "And when Ahithophel saw that his counsel was not followed, he saddled his ass and arose and got him home to his house, to his city, and put his household in order and hanged himself and died and was buried in the sepulcher of his father." Now you talk about a type A personality. This guy, whenever he is so angry and furious that people have wounded his pride and not taken his counsel, he doesn't just go shoot himself. No, he goes back home. He puts his thing in order. He makes sure his will is up to date, makes sure everything's in its proper place and everybody knows where to find everything and all the bank accounts are settled. And then he hangs himself. I hate to say it, but if I ever kill myself, that's probably what I'd do too. I'd make sure everything was in order. I want you to know where all the passwords are and everything. I don't want anybody to be having to do a bunch of extra work trying to figure things out. I'm not going to do that, Lord willing. But anyway, that's kind of the type of personality that I am. Most of you would just say, oh, the heck with it. They can figure it out. Bang!
That's right.
But just think about this. How many times has this happened to you at work or at home or even in the church? Maybe you have a really good idea or think you have a good idea. And then you take it to your boss or to somebody and they look at it and they say, well, that's stupid. That's dumb. I mean, you have a tendency to want to get mad, right? What do you mean that's dumb? That's the best idea I've heard. You're going to take this guy's idea over my idea? So that's one of the underlying causes of being easily provoked. You see, we esteem ourselves better than others, and we think that their ideas are stupid. And that irritates us. Isn't that irritating? Especially if somebody picks a dumb idea over ours. That's irritating. We get angry quickly. And when someone doesn't treat us with the respect that we deserve or that we think we deserve. You see, that's part of our pride problem. We think so highly of ourselves, and when somebody meets us and doesn't respect us like we think they should, then we start to feel this provocation. We start to feel this anger. After all, I am whoever you are, whoever I am. Well, I am a pastor. He should have treated me better than that. I am a manager. What do you mean you're going to talk to me like that? I'm your husband. Why would you talk to me like that? And you might be right. She shouldn't talk to you like that. He shouldn't talk to his manager like that. But still, we shouldn't get easily provoked. Even if it is a legitimate provocation, we still shouldn't get easily provoked. Let me give you an example of this one. Whenever we don't get the respect that we think we deserve, and we get mad. Turn to Esther 3, 1 through 5. Now, sometimes the respect that we think we deserve is not even justified anyway. We don't deserve that respect. And this is such a case. This is a man named Haman, back in the book of Esther. Haman did not deserve the respect that he was getting. And there was a guy named Mordecai, who was a Jew, who was not giving him that respect. Not for the sake of disrespecting him, but for the sake of obeying God. Esther 3, 1 through 5. After these things, did King Ahasuerus promote Haman, the son of Hammedatha. There we go. Son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and advanced him to set his seat above all the princes that were with him. I'm in Esther 3 and verse 2. And all the king's servants that were in the king's gate bowed and reverenced Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence. And boy, is that going to irritate Haman. Then the king's servants, which were in the king's gate, said unto Mordecai, why transgressest thou the king's commandment? Now it came to pass, when they spake daily unto him, and he hearkened not unto them, that they told Haman to see whether Mordecai's matters would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. All he had to tell them was who he was. He didn't have to give them any other explanation. They knew. They know that Jews worship the true God, and that people that worship the true God cannot bow down to men. This is the trouble that all the early Christians got themselves in Rome. They would not bow down to the Roman gods. They would not do that. They obeyed God rather than men. And look at what happens here. Look at what Haman thinks of all this. And when verse 5, and when Haman saw that Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence, then was Haman full of wrath. He was easily provoked. He had everybody in that kingdom bowing down to him, but one little Jew would not bow down to him, and he is full of wrath. Why? Because he was proud. How dare you not bow down to me? After all, I am an honored man in the kingdom. You can easily see how pride is a source of easy provocation. Okay, so what's the solution to this? On all seven of these things that I'm going to give you, I'm going to give you the reasoning for it, why these particular things cause us to be easily provoked, are the cause of it anyway, and then I'm going to show you what the solution is. So what's the solution? Well, first of all, we must hate our pride. Look at Proverbs 8 and verse 13. You're never going to deal with your pride until you first hate it. You're never going to deal with any sin until you hate that sin. Proverbs 8 and verse 13 says, "The fear of the Lord is to hate evil. Pride and arrogancy and the evil way and the froward mouth do I hate," wisdom says. Wisdom, Jesus Christ, is the wisdom of God. Jesus Christ hates pride, arrogancy, and the evil way. And the fear of the Lord is for us to hate those things too. If we fear God, we should hate our pride. It's an easy one. It creeps up on you out of nowhere. You're just going along and all of a sudden you have this thought, "Boy, I did a good job on that. Boy, I am really something." And then you catch yourself. You say, "I hate it when I do that." That's what you should do. So we must hate our pride. Then we must humble ourselves. Look at James 4, 6 through 10. Here's a good one. Whenever you have a desire or an inclination to promote your own work, whatever it may be, stop yourself. It's tough to do. I know what I'm talking about. It's tough to do. Because then you think, well, if I don't promote my stuff, who's going to? But you know what? If it's truly notable, it'll get around. People will find out about it. You don't need to do it yourself. James 4, 6 through 10. "Let another man praise thee," Solomon said. "Let another man praise thee, not thine own mouth, a stranger, not thine own lips." Okay, anyway, James 4 and verses 6 and 10. "But he giveth more grace. Wherefore he saith, God resisteth the proud, but giveth grace unto the humble." Verse 10, "Humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord, and he shall lift you up." So not only will doing this help you to not be easily provoked, but this will also lift you up, build you up, because God will be on your side. You see, God resists the proud. So when we think too highly of ourselves, God says, "Oh, you think you're so high? Let me push you down a bit." But whenever we think of ourselves the way we ought to, and we think of ourselves lowly, and we realize what we really are, and we know what we would be if it were not for the help of God already, then God says, "Here, let me lift you up a little bit. Let me make you feel a little better." That's how it works. So we hate our pride, number one. We humble ourselves, number two. We realize what we really are. Look at Romans 12 and verse 3. You see, Christians, if they are truly Christians, they know what they really are. They know what is inside of them. It's the wicked out there that think that they're good people. You ever talk to somebody out there? "What do I need Jesus for? I'm a good person." Are you? That's why you need Jesus, because you're full of pride. Romans 12 and verse 3. "For I say, through the grace given unto me, to every man that is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think soberly, according as God hath dealt to every man the measure of faith." We were just talking about that verse in our Bible study on Wednesday. God's the one that gives faith, and he gives to every man a measure of it. Some get a bigger measure than others. We can't boast about a gift that's been given to us, can we? Why would you boast if you're taller than somebody else, or more beautiful than somebody else, or something that you had nothing at all to do with? Well, the same thing goes for your faith. God gives to every man a measure of faith. We ought not to think more highly of ourselves than we should. Look at Romans 7 and verse 8. We have to realize what we really are. Now here's the Apostle Paul. One of the greatest Christians, the greatest Christian to ever live that I am aware of. The greatest Christian ever. And here's what he said about himself. Romans 7 and verse 18. "For I know that in me, that is in my flesh, dwelleth no good thing. For to will is present with me, but how to perform that which is good, I find not." There's what Paul thought of himself. That no good thing dwells in him, in his flesh. He knows what's in him. He knows what a rotten sinner he is. And that's why he was the greatest Christian that ever lived, because he knew what was really in him. And he knew that by the grace of God, I am what I am, he said in 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 10. And lastly, Once we've done those things, then we need to learn to esteem others more highly than ourselves. You see, it's pretty darn hard to esteem others more highly than yourself when you think highly of yourself. How are you going to esteem others more highly than you, which you obviously think that you're the highest already? That's the whole point of a proud person. They think that they're the best. Well, if you esteem others higher than you, then you're not the best anymore. So you got to humble yourself first, hate your pride first, realize what's in yourself first, and then you can think more highly of others than yourself. And then you will not get so easily provoked whenever somebody doesn't like your idea because you realize, you know what, I'm not all that wise anyway. Maybe somebody else does have a better idea. Maybe I should consider that. Look at Romans 12 and verse 16. See, I'm trying to do like a good doctor would, and not just treat the symptoms, but treat the underlying cause. Figure out what's causing it. Not just giving you a bunch of pills to take care of the symptoms. Like if you go to a mechanic and you got all your check engine lights on, and he says, "Ha, I got an easy, quick solution for that." And he just pulls out your instrument panel and pops all the lights out. Well, thanks. Now there's nothing wrong with my car anymore, right? Romans 12 and verse 16. It says, "Be of the same mind, one toward another. Mind not high things, but condescend to men of low estate. Be not wise in your own conceits," in your own thoughts, in your own estimation of yourself. Be not wise. Give God the credit for it. Realize that anything you are, by the grace of God, I am what I am. Look at Philippians 2 and verse 3. Philippians 2 and verse 3. It says, "Let nothing be done through strife or vainglory, but in lowliness of mind let each esteem other better than themselves." Now, maybe you are the best, I don't know, come up with a trade, the best welder that's ever been. Maybe you truly are the best welder. And you look at this guy that is just an entering apprentice, and he's a terrible welder. It would be ridiculous to say, "Well, I think that you're a better welder than I am." No, that's just dumb, right? I mean, that's not what this is talking about. But you can esteem others better than yourself because there might be something about that apprentice that's working for you that is better than yourself. Maybe he is a better communicator or a better writer than you are, a better people person than you are. Or maybe he's better at some other trade than you are. You can still esteem the person better than yourself. And you do that by showing him respect. Because don't we respect people that we think to be better than ourselves? So whenever you show respect, even unto a little child or any person, you are, in a sense, esteeming them better than yourself because you are respecting that person. Okay, number two, the second reason why we become easily provoked, and that is weakness of character. You see, sometimes we are insecure and we feel inadequate, and therefore we respond with anger when we're questioned or challenged to attempt to silence our critic. You ever meet somebody like that? They put on a facade like they're this big tough guy, right? And as soon as somebody questions them, they immediately respond with anger and they stand up and they're going to be tough, right? And then they put the other, and then the other kind of scares the other guy back, and then he doesn't, "Oh, I'm not going to question him anymore." You see, but this is not a strong person. He looks like a strong person. When he could stand up to somebody and raise his voice and back them down, he looks strong. But he's not. He's weak. He's afraid that he might be wrong, that he might be shown to be not the tough guy that he thinks he is. So he responds back with quick anger because you got to hit him quick, right? It's like if you're going into a fight and you're the littler guy, well, you better walk up there and right out of the blue cock the guy right in the face. Because otherwise, you can't match him. You got to have the soon anger, right? That's the weak guy. The weak guy that gets loud immediately, he's the one. You can tell the guy that lost the argument. The guy that gets mad and starts screaming first has lost the argument. He's just trying to back the other guy down now and intimidate him. This is one of the reasons why we get easily provoked. This happens to a person like this when his beliefs are challenged. You ever see somebody weak in their faith? And their beliefs are challenged, and they get mad, and they instantly start calling names, or they start calling you names, or saying, "Oh, you're just in a cult, or you're crazy." That's the weak person. Look at Acts 19, 23 through 28. This is the kind of person that you don't even want to go up to him and question him or ask him about anything because you know he's going to blow up. This is the boss at work that, boy, if you even would dare to question anything that he's said or thought to do, you know, boy, I'm going to get a tongue lashing from this one. And you don't even want to talk to the guy. God forbid, as your pastor, I would be that way. And I think all of you, if I polled you, would say that I'm not that way. If you come up to me and ask me something, I'm not going to try to scream you down or tell you, look, you don't understand. If you had as much knowledge of the Bible as I did, you'd understand. Just don't ask questions like that. You just let me tell you how things are in the Bible. I don't act like that. God forbid that I ever will. Acts 19, 23 through 28. It says, and the same time there arose no small stir about that way. For a certain man named Demetrius, a silversmith which made silver shrines for Diana, brought no small gain unto the craftsmen, whom he called together with the workmen of like occupation, and said, Sirs, you know that by this craft we have our wealth. You see, here's the problem. This guy's going to lose his income if these Christians come in and tell everybody in Ephesus that Diana is just an idol, that she's no god whatsoever. Well, they're not going to buy his silver shrines anymore, and he's going to be out of business. Moreover, ye see and hear that not alone at Ephesus, but also throughout all Asia, this Paul hath persuaded and turned away much people, saying that they be no gods which are made with hands. Well, there's a shocker. Wow. So that not only this our craft is in danger, to be set at naught, but also that the temple of the great goddess Diana should be despised, and her magnificence should be destroyed, whom all Asia and the world worshipeth. Notice the order of his concern here. Not only is our craft in jeopardy here, but also the magnificence of Diana. The whole world worships her. But you see what his real concern is. It's in his pocket. Verse 28, And when they heard these sayings, they were full of wrath and cried out, saying, Great is Diana of the Ephesians. Typical sinners, right there. Typical people of weak character couldn't defend this stupid goddess Diana if they had to. There is no defense of this superstition. But they get mad instantly and they start yelling, Great is Diana of the Ephesians. And then they get the whole town in an uproar and they all start yelling the same thing for the space of 2 hours, it goes on to say. This is the reasoning of people with weak character. Shout them down. This is the social justice warriors of today. You know, when a conservative, I'm not really a conservative politically so much, but I would hold a lot of the conservative views socially or whatever. But anyway, conservatives come onto a college campus now, and these so-called social justice warriors, the SJWs, they literally will shout the person down and not let them speak. At colleges, which are supposed to be, aren't these the place with open flow of ideas and there's no idea that's taboo, and we're supposed to all be able to voice our opinions and seek the truth. There is no freedom of speech, especially in some of these college campuses. At the major ones, the Ivy League schools, Harvard and Yale, some of the biggest ones are the worst offenders. It is pathetic. I like, though, the University of Chicago, total side note, but the University of Chicago just came out. They didn't do a press release, but they did it to the letter, their letter to their freshmen. And they basically said, we're not putting up with this crap. I mean, that's my paraphrase. But there will be free flow of ideas here, and you will not shut somebody else down because you don't like what they have to say. And which I think is great. And I'm sure that the pendulum might swing the other way then, away from this nonsense. But anyway, that's a total side note. Now here's the thing. When we despise reproof and instruction, we're acting like fools. So the weak person who thinks that he's got the best idea, and then you come to talk to him about it, and he doesn't even want to hear your reproof or your instruction because maybe he'd be found out to be wrong and that would wound his pride. That's ultimately his problem too. Then he lashes back at you. He's showing himself to be a fool. Look at Proverbs 1 and verse 7. You show me a person that when you go to him and question him about something or try to show him where he's wrong about something, and he gets angry about it, I will show you a fool. Proverbs 1 and verse 7. It says, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. The guy that despises wisdom and instruction is a fool. And you know what the Bible says? Go from the presence of a foolish man when thou perceivest not in him the lips of knowledge. Whenever you have given a fool instruction or reproof and he despises you for it, just stop giving him the instruction anymore. Proverbs 9 tells you that. Don't you rebuke a fool, you get yourself a blot. Let God deal with that guy. Look at Proverbs 23 and verse 9. It says, speak not in the ears of a fool, for he will despise the wisdom of thy words. He doesn't thank you. You know, whenever you got a guy that maybe your boss, maybe he has come up with a policy that's not the brightest, and there's some blind spot that he didn't quite see, something is going to really mess this up in the future. And you point it out and you say, hey, did you think of this? You know, what could happen if we enact this policy? He doesn't say, that's a good idea. You know what? I think you're right. Thanks for that. No. He says, don't you tell me. I've been in this job way longer than you have. You don't even know what you're talking about. Get out of here. That's the fool. Proverbs 15, 5 and 12. Proverbs 15, 5 and 12. A fool despiseth his father's instruction, but he that regardeth reproof is prudent. You see the difference there? The fool doesn't want to hear the instruction, but the guy that regards the reproof, he's the prudent man, the wise man. A wise man, I think it was Socrates said this, that or something like this anyway, that a wise man is the person that realizes that he doesn't know much or doesn't know anything. Look at verse 12. It says, a scorner loveth not one that reproveth him, neither will he go unto the wise. And one more, Proverbs 13 and verse 1. It says, a wise son heareth his father's instruction, but a scorner heareth not rebuke. So if you're one that gets soon angry when somebody questions you, you are a fool. Now, what's the solution to this one? Well, we must accept our weaknesses, and then we must receive others' questions, challenges, or reproofs as opportunities to grow in knowledge and wisdom. You see, when somebody has the guts to come up to you, maybe with goodwill, maybe even not with goodwill, but regardless, if somebody's got the guts to come up to you and address something with you that they think that you're wrong on, especially that might cause you a lot of harm and pain down the road, you ought to thank the person for that, and you ought to consider that information, consider that advice, and whatever you deem to be correct, put it into practice. And you know what? Give the guy credit for it too. That'll get you on his good side. Somebody comes to a boss and says, hey, you know, I got an idea here. Give the guy the credit for it if he's the one that came up with it. Don't take it for yourself. That guy, he will be on your side forever then. He'll have your back. Look at Proverbs 9, 8 through 9. That's like just in my own situation. If one of you came up to me and said, you know what, Pastor, I think that something you've taught isn't quite right. Look at this verse and look at this verse and compare these two passages. You see this? Now, if I was an idiot, I'd say, oh, you think you know more Bible than I do? Come on now. If I was smart, I would look at it and I'd say, you know what, I think you're right. And then I'd get up there and I'd tell the church, Brother so-and-so pointed this out to me. Thank you, Brother so-and-so. That's the right thing to do. Proverbs 9, 8 through 9. Reprove not a scorner, lest he hate thee. Rebuke a wise man, and he will love thee. Give instruction to a wise man, and he will be yet wiser. Teach a just man, and he will increase in learning. That's what we ought to do. Accept our weakness, and then take that reproof as an opportunity to learn and to grow. Proverbs 17 and verse 10. Proverbs 17 and verse 10. It says, a reproof entereth more into a wise man than 100 stripes into a fool. You can take a wise man, give him a reproof, And he takes that thing right away. You can take a fool and beat him 100 times, and he still won't take it. Aren't some, you know, people with kids, you know, kids are usually, you got at least one strong-willed one and one that's fairly compliant. The compliant one, you can just tell him, go clean your room, and he just goes and cleans his room. The strong-willed one, you got to tell him 3 times, and you got to beat him 4 more, and then he still might not clean his room. Right? That's just how it is sometimes. Look at Psalm 141 in verse 5. This is the attitude that we all should try to adopt. Psalm 141 in verse 5. David said, let the righteous smite me, it shall be a kindness. And let him reprove me, it shall be an excellent oil, which shall not break my head. For yet my prayer also shall be in their calamities. David says, let a righteous man smite me, and I'll consider it a kindness. It's not going to break my head, it's going to be an excellent oil, it's going to help me. David welcomed reproof whenever he was wrong. He welcomed rebuke. And not only was he thankful for it, but yet he would pray for that person that reproved him in the day of their calamity. He was so thankful to God for somebody that would reprove him when he was wrong, he would even pray for that person. So the solution to this weakness of character will not only help you to not be easily provoked, but it'll help you to have a stronger character too. It'll help you to be a better person. Number three, the third reason why we get easily provoked is selfishness. This one's probably more true than any of the rest, I would say. You see, we're more concerned with ourselves and our own needs than we are with the needs of others, and we get easily provoked when others ask us for something when we're trying to satisfy our own needs or desires. Think about it. How many times do you get irritated because you're trying to do something, and maybe rightly so. Maybe you should be doing whatever you're doing right now, and the other person shouldn't be bothering you. But even so, regardless, maybe you're just watching TV and it's really not anything important at all. But we are more concerned about our own needs, even if that's just our own need to veg out and relax for a minute. We're more concerned about that. And then when the husband or the wife says, honey, can you do this for me? You're like, I'm watching TV. Don't bother me. But we shouldn't do that. Or think about it. And I've seen this with parents, and I admire parents that do this. When they got kids that are trying to eat, and the parents are feeding the kids before they eat, and the kid, you know, I've seen that with different parents, and I admire that because I'm thinking, you know, I want to eat when it's hot. When it's there, I mean, I want to start eating. And you think you got kids, and by the time you get them fed and everything, then your food's cold and you're eating last. But you know, that's what it is to be a parent, right? But I can imagine, I haven't been there yet, but I can imagine it's pretty easy to be provoked. You sit down, you want to eat, maybe you got their stuff all dished up, and you just go to eat, and poof, there goes the glass of milk on the table. And I just want to eat, right? You ever been there? Ever been there? Kids are laughing because they're the culprits. They know, they've been there. Look at Romans 12 and verse 10. I'll show you the solution to this. It's to learn to deny ourselves and to put others' needs before ourselves. Now this is hard. This goes against our nature. Because our nature is to take care of number one, right? Aren't we most concerned about ourselves? Every one of us. It's hard to learn to put others first. That's why marriage helps with that. And I'll bet you having kids helps even more. I'm not there yet, but I'll bet you that helps you to be less selfish. Romans 12 and verse 10. It says, be kindly affectioned one to another with brotherly love, in honor preferring one another. Now to prefer means to put forward or advance in status, rank, or fortune, to promote to a position or office of dignity. There's another primary definition of that, and it is to put or set in front or before, which really goes well with the context of this definition here, because it says preferring, what was the verse I already lost at 12:10, preferring one another. I thought there was another place where it says put another before yourself. It must be in a different verse. But anyway, to prefer is to put someone else in front of yourself. Think about it. If you prefer Coke over Pepsi, if you had your chance, you'd put the Coke in front of the Pepsi, right? You'd put it in front. Well, to prefer one another is to put the other person in front of you, put their needs in front of yours. Look at 1 Corinthians 13 and verse 5. This goes back to the very verse that we've been looking at for the last two Sundays, and I want to show you what is tied with not being easily provoked. 1 Corinthians 13 and verse 5. It says, "Charity doth not behave itself unseemly, seeketh not her own, is not easily provoked, thinketh no evil." You see, charity seeks not her own. In other words, charity is not selfish, because when we're selfish, we seek our own needs. When we are selfless, we seek other people's needs first. Look at 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 24, back a page. First Corinthians 10:24. "Let no man seek his own, but every man another's wealth." Most of us seek our own wealth, whether that's financial wealth or spiritual wealth or whatever, our own well-being. But the Bible tells us to seek another's well-being before ourselves. Look at Philippians 2 and verse 4. Philippians 2 and verse 4. Says, "Look not every man on his own things, but every man also on the things of others." That's not looking at their things like how you can get them. That's looking on their things, being concerned about their things, being concerned about their life. You can tell if you're a selfish person or not when you talk to somebody. Do you talk about yourself the whole time, or are you interested and you ask other people questions about themselves? And when they tell you something about themselves, do you respond back with something about what they told you, or do you automatically turn it around and start talking about yourself again? Just a thought. So, selfishness, one of the major reasons of being provoked. So when we learn to put others' needs in front of our own, we won't be nearly as easily provoked whenever somebody interrupts whatever we're doing to get us to help them out. We should think, oh, what an opportunity to put the things of others before myself. I would gladly get up and get that dish for you up in the upper shelf rather than do whatever I'm doing, because I value your needs higher than my needs. Don't I sound like the best pious Christian ever? That's exactly how it happens every time too. Yeah, right. Okay, number four, spoiledness. We want what we want when we want it, and we don't want to wait for it. That is our generation today, is it not? Well, this would obviously lead to being easily provoked. If I'm used to having what I want when I want it, and I don't wait, if anything happens that causes me to have to wait, even a minuscule amount of time, I'm going to be angry. And boy, don't you see that everywhere we go? On the roads, in the grocery stores, anywhere. I'll tell you what, if you want to learn to not be easily provoked, make a trip at least once a week down to the local government place where they give you your driver's license and marriage license and all that stuff, whatever that place is called. You will learn patience, let me tell you what. You're not going to get out of there in less than an hour. I've had to go there a couple times as of late. But let me think. I'm going to give you three examples here, maybe even four. Our parents or grandparents had to spend a few hours going to the library to research something. Right? When they wanted information, they go to the library. You take a couple hours. You got to drive out there. You got to look at the book, search for it, and all that. But we get furious if a web page takes a few seconds to load. Think about that. We're spoiled. Previous generations lived their entire lives without air conditioning. Their entire lives. My poor wife lived over in the Philippines where it was blazing hot and rarely ran her air conditioning, maybe on the weekends if she could afford it. So on the fifth floor in a tiny little apartment with fans going when it's 90-some degrees outside and about that same level of humidity. Think about that. So previous generations lived their entire lives without air conditioning, yet we get irritated if ours goes out for even a few hours. We're spoiled. The pilgrims had to spend weeks traveling across the ocean to get to America. And yet we get irate if our six-hour flight to Europe gets delayed by a couple hours. They had to literally go across on these nasty, stinky boats for weeks to get over here. And we are downright mad if that flight gets delayed, which would take us a whole 6 hours to ride in a comfortable chair across the ocean. You know, in previous generations, you'd try to send a letter across this country, and what would it take? Weeks? I mean, several generations ago, with the Pony Express, weeks to get a letter across from one coast to the other. Now, we get irritated if our text message doesn't get answered in minutes. What's wrong with this guy? I mean, I've given him 10 minutes to respond to this text. What a jerk, you know? People are so inconsiderate. That's what we think, right? Isn't that what we think? That's why we get easily provoked. We're too spoiled. What's the solution to that one? Well, we must learn to be content and thankful for what we have. Look at Hebrews 13 and verse 5. I recommend getting in the mindset of teaching yourself to marvel at all of the things that we have today. Maybe I was born too late, but I often marvel at just everything that we have. It's just amazing to me. You drive out on the streets, you see the buildings, you see the phones, the computers, just all this stuff, and you think all these random people from all over the planet all simultaneously got together without having any one dude with a bullhorn, and they all digged in the earth and mined these materials and refined them and then shipped them around to each other and built these amazing devices that we have. And it all just seems to magically happen with the invisible hand of the free market. If you adopt that attitude, you probably won't get so irritated when it takes more than a minute to get a text message back. When you're looking at this thing and thinking, wow, I can actually send a message from this thing in my hand to some guy in another state in a second. That's amazing. Then maybe you'll have a little better appreciation for what we have, and you won't get so easily provoked. Hebrews 13 and verse 5. You ever think about it? Just go to the grocery store and just look around and think, this is amazing. We've got food from all over the world, and some dude down there in Central America or in Asia somehow knew that I'm going to want this particular fruit on this particular day, and there just happens to be one here. That's amazing. And he doesn't even know me. Hebrews 13 and verse 5. Let your conversation be without covetousness, and be content with such things as ye have, for he hath said, I will never leave thee nor forsake thee. Be content with what you have. You won't be so spoiled, and you won't be so prone to being easily provoked. Look at 1 Timothy 6 and verse 8. And having food and raiment, that is clothing, let us be therewith content. If we were content, we wouldn't be so easily provoked. Number 5. This one sort of goes into number 4. Unthankfulness and ungratefulness. You see, our problem is we are not thankful. Like reprobates. I'll give you the verse. I'll give you the verse that reprobates are unthankful. But we are unthankful like they are for what we have, and therefore we get irritated instead of suffering small provocations. Let me first show you that reprobates are unthankful. And if you are unthankful, then you are acting like a reprobate, which if I were you, I would probably try to rectify before you find yourself burning in the lake of fire or something. Romans 1 and verse 21. Because that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. This is the beginning. This is the beginning of the rest of the chapter, and I think we're all familiar with Romans 1, when they go into fornication, into sodomy, and then into all these horrible things like murder, debate, deceit, fornication, maliciousness, malignity, whispers, backbiters, all those horrible things. But it started out with the fundamental thing. They were not thankful. They didn't glorify God as God. And they were not thankful. Look at 2 Timothy 3 and verse 2. 2 Timothy 3 and verse 2. Paul says in verse 1, "This know also, that in the last days perilous times shall come, for men shall be lovers of their own selves." There's that selfishness I was telling you about. "Covetous." There's that spoiledness I was telling you about. "Boasters." There's the pride I was telling you about. "Proud." "Blasphemers." "Disobedient to parents." "Unthankful." "Unholy." You see, all these things are characteristics of reprobates that I've been talking about so far. So we're not thankful for what we have, then we get easily provoked. For instance, if a man is not thankful and grateful for the wife that God has given him, then he'll get easily provoked by her actions and her statements, won't he? Or if a wife is not thankful and grateful for the husband that God's given her, she'll get easily provoked by the things that he says and does. If parents are not grateful for the children that God gave them, they will be easily provoked by their childishness and their immaturity. You see, if you look at that child and you think of this as a gift and a blessing from God, it's going to be a lot harder to get provoked at them when they act like kids. Now, if they act bad and you need to spank them, that's a different story. You've been provoked, rightly so, and you need to spank them. But when they're acting like kids, that's a different story. So what's the solution to this one? We must learn to have an attitude of gratitude. Look at Psalm 100 and verse 4. "I know the honeymoon phase wears off after a while," they say, "but I hope that I never lose the thankfulness that I have for my wife, because I am so thankful and so happy that God gave her to me. Now I just need to learn to act like that more often, and I'll be doing all right."
Takes time.
Yeah, it takes time, that's right. Psalm 100 and verse 4. I've really been working on it, though. I didn't realize how irritable I was until I got married. Psalm 100 and verse 4.
Your mom told me.
Yeah, well, you knew, I guess, but nobody else did. Now I've outed myself. Psalm 100 and verse 4. Yeah, I got to keep my mom and my family away from you people. They'll end up telling you things that you shouldn't know. Psalm 100 and verse 4. "Enter into his gates with thanksgiving and into his courts with praise. Be thankful unto him and bless his name." We need to have an attitude of gratitude. Look at Colossians 3 and verse 15. Colossians 3 and verse 15. "And let the peace of God rule in your hearts, to the which also ye are called in one body, and be ye thankful." That's one of the characteristics that we should have as Christians, is that we should be thankful people. We should thank God all the time. Thank God when you wake up in the morning. Thank God before your meals. Thank God whenever you get paid. I thank God every time I get paid. Every time money comes, I thank the Lord for his bountiful goodness. That'll help you to not be so easily provoked. Number 6 is unmercifulness. This is a real problem. You see, sometimes we are not merciful in understanding, once again, like reprobates. And when someone does or says something that we deem stupid or annoying, we allow ourselves to be provoked. Because we just don't have mercy on people. That's a problem. Look at Romans 1 and verse 31. Let me show you that this is the characteristic of a reprobate. He's unmerciful. He didn't cut anybody any slack. Somebody does or says something stupid, and he's ready to cut them off. Romans 1 and verse 31. "Without understanding, covenant breakers, without natural affection, implacable, unmerciful." Interesting there. I'm using the term understanding more like understanding people's situations. The scripture here is probably really referring to understanding with like out understanding of the Lord and things like that. But still, it is interesting that without understanding and unmerciful are linked together here. So I kind of take something from that anyway. We think that people should know better, and we get impatient when they don't live up to our standards. We're just not merciful enough with them. It's pretty easy to get that way with kids, right? Because kids, I mean, they're not adults, and you wish they would act like adults sometimes, right? And I'm sure that gets hard not to be provoked sometimes when they act not quite in the way that you think they should. You see, husbands need to watch out for this and to remember that their wives are the weaker vessels. Look at 1 Peter 3 and verse 7. You see, Peter knew that this was a tendency that men had to get irritable with their wives, and that's why he put this in the scripture. 1 Peter 3 and verse 7. He says, "Likewise, ye husbands, dwell with them," that is, the wives, "according to knowledge, giving honor unto the wife as unto the weaker vessel, and as being heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers be not hindered." So the wife is the weaker vessel. So you can't expect her to be as strong as you are. Of course, not physically strong, but not as emotionally strong. You can't expect that from her. She's going to be more emotional. She's going to make decisions based on her feelings more than on pure logic. And that can be frustrating for a man, right? Especially a man that tends to think logically. When you're like, you have just analyzed it all, you've put it into a syllogism, therefore this is the correct decision. She's like, well, that's just not what I feel like. Well, who cares what you feel like? Look, the syllogism, major premise, minor premise, conclusion, the feelings don't matter, right? That's what men think. But that's not, you can't treat women like men. Women are not men. You have to be patient with them. Husbands are not to be bitter against their wives. Look at Colossians 3 and verse 19. Why do you suppose this verse is in the Bible? Maybe because men have a tendency to be bitter against their wives. Colossians 3 and verse 19. Husbands, love your wives, and be not bitter against them. You see, you're supposed to love them, cherish them, have affection for them. That's the opposite of being bitter. You're supposed to be warm towards them. Look at Ephesians 5:25, and then 28 and 29. Ephesians 5:25, 28 and 29. It says, husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it. How would you feel if you went to the throne of grace and asked Jesus for help in time of need, and he's bitter with you and says, I'm busy right now, get out of here, I'm trying to do something. How would that make you feel? Not very well. Verse 28 and 29, so ought men to love their wives even as their own bodies. He that loveth his wife loveth himself. For no man ever yet hated his own flesh, but nourisheth and cherisheth it, even as the Lord the church. Husbands, we are supposed to love our wives and cherish them. To love means to bear love to entertain with great affection or regard for, to hold dear. Entertain with great affection. We should look at our wives and feel a genuine love towards them. We should want to do what is best for them, have their well-being as our number one priority. We're supposed to cherish them, which means to hold dear, treat with tenderness and affection, to make much of. Tenderness, affection. Give her hugs. Give her kisses. Tell her how much you appreciate her meals that she cooks for you every day. How much you appreciate all that she does. One person put in our wedding card to make sure and give your wife 6 non-sexual hugs per day. I thought that was pretty good advice. Coming from a woman, of course. You know. So what's the solution to this? To being, when we're unmerciful and then we're easily provoked whenever that idiot did something that he shouldn't have done, and now I'm ready to choose. Or to, whatever, bite his head off or something like that. Say chew his something, but bite his head off is better. Well, the solution is that we must learn to show mercy rather than judgment if we want God to show mercy to us. Look at Luke 6 and verse 36. Luke 6 and verse 36. The Lord Jesus said, be ye therefore merciful as your Father also is merciful. Didn't God save us according to his mercy, we're told? You see, if God wasn't merciful, we'd all be going to hell. We're supposed to be merciful like he is. Look at James 2 and verse 13. This is the best verse on this topic in the Bible, in my opinion. James 2 and verse 13. For he shall have judgment without mercy that hath showed no mercy, and mercy rejoiceth against judgment. Now, if we want to have mercy, we've got to show mercy. But if we don't show mercy, we will have judgment without mercy. You see that? We must show mercy in order to expect mercy. Look at Matthew 5 and verse 7. Matthew 5 and verse 7. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. And Psalm 18 and verse 25. We've got to learn to cut people some slack. Psalm 18 and verse 25, it says, with the merciful thou wilt show thyself merciful. With an upright man thou wilt show thyself upright. With the pure thou wilt show thyself pure. And with the froward thou wilt show thyself froward. So you've got to be careful, because if we don't treat others right, God will give it back to us in kind as a judgment against us. All right, number 7. The 7th underlying reason why we are easily provoked is a lack of love, compassion, and respect. You see, we get easily annoyed and angry with people because we don't love and respect them as we should. If you really love and you really respect somebody, you shouldn't get easily irritated and annoyed with them. I've starred this next one here, this next point. I think if I want you to take anything away from this sermon today, I think maybe this point is the most important one. We show more respect to strangers than we do to our own spouses, children, siblings, parents, and brethren. This should not be so. You think about that. You would not treat an acquaintance of yours the way that you treat your own spouse, your own children, your own parents, your own close friends, your own brethren in church. Why wouldn't you treat an acquaintance like that? Well, you don't want them to think you're a jerk, right? I mean, I don't want to look bad in their sight. I don't want to offend them. They just cut me off and wouldn't have anything to do with me anymore. So why is it that we can treat strangers better than we treat those whom we love the most? I would say because we're not afraid to lose the ones that we love the most, that we know that we got their love no matter what. They love us unconditionally, so therefore we mistreat them. But that's wrong. That is wrong. I'd say a good rule of thumb is treat your spouse, your children, parents, church brethren, treat them better than you'd treat a stranger. I mean, that's a pretty good rule of thumb. Because when you meet a stranger, at least somebody that you've been introduced to, you're pretty nice to them, you're friendly with them, you'd never say anything that would hurt their feelings, right? You're on your best behavior. So here's your rule of thumb. Treat those whom you love the most better than strangers, and you're going to be doing pretty good. So the solution is to be compassionate, and courteous. Look at Romans 12 and verse 10. Romans 12 and verse 10. Be kindly affectioned one to another with brotherly love, in honor preferring one another. Kindly affection one to another. That's to your church brethren, specifically here in this context, but that's to your family members, your spouse, children. We're even told that we're supposed to do good unto all men when we have opportunity, so we ought to treat all men with respect and courteousness. And look at 1 Peter 3, 8 through 9. 1 Peter 3, 8 through 9. Finally, be ye all of one mind, having compassion one of another, love as brethren, be pitiful, be courteous, not rendering evil for evil or railing for railing, but contrariwise blessing, knowing that ye are thereunto called, that ye should inherit a blessing. You see how being compassionate, pitiful, and courteous is in setting contrast to railing for railing, or in other words, being easily provoked. If we have compassion and pitifulness and courteousness towards people, we will not be easily provoked with them. Now, let me quickly go through some steps to take to overcome being easily provoked. I've sort of already given you a bunch, but I'm going to give you some different ones here. Number one, and this is probably in any 12-step program. I don't have 12 steps. So I got 9 of them, so this is not a 12-step program. But number one is to recognize and admit you have a problem. That's the first step. And in other words, put in biblical terminology, acknowledge your sin. Look at Psalm 32 and verse 5. If you refuse to acknowledge your sin, you're never going to get past it. If any of you tell me in here that you are never easily provoked, I'm going to talk to your spouse, and I will probably find out otherwise. Psalm 32 and verse 5, or your children. That's the great thing about children, is they usually tell the truth, especially when it's embarrassing for you. Psalm 32 and verse 5, David says, I acknowledged my sin unto thee, and mine iniquity have I not hid. I said, I will confess my transgressions unto the Lord, and thou forgavest the iniquity of my sin. There's the first step. I acknowledged my sin. Acknowledge means to own the knowledge of. You got to admit to yourself who you are first before you can ever take steps to fix yourself. Look at Psalm 51 and verse 3. For I acknowledge my transgressions, and my sin is ever before me. David speaking again. So after you've acknowledged and admitted that you have a problem with being easily provoked, then you have to confess your sin to God and get specific about it. 1 John 1:9 says, if we confess our sins, He is faithful and just to forgive us our sins and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness. So if we confess them, God will forgive them. But what you want to do is you want to get specific about that. Number one, you want to tell God that you sinned against Him. It wasn't just your spouse or your children or your parents or your brother in the church or your boss or whoever. It was against God, ultimately, that you sinned whenever you were easily provoked. Psalm 51 and verse 4, David says, against thee, thee only, have I sinned and done this evil in thy sight, that thou mightest be justified when thou speakest and be clear when thou judgest. David recognized, Lord, I've sinned against thee, and you are in the right for judging me however you see fit. The next thing you do, and you want to get specific about it too, tell the Lord, Lord, forgive me for being easily provoked with my wife whenever she did thus and so and I reacted how I shouldn't have. Or when I got mad and frustrated and flipped out on my kids for being kids or whatever. Get specific about it. Whenever I got irritated when I had to wait 2 seconds at that red light, started ranting and raving and yell, scream, swear, and holler, acting like a fool. Tell the Lord what you did. Then you want to forsake your sin. I had to get that red light thing in there. I was all over that last time, and then I've kind of dropped the ball on that one. Because isn't traffic one of the main provocations that we have? How many of us get irritated when we're in traffic? I mean, that happens. That's pretty easy. It's pretty easy to get irritated, and it's hard to train yourself not to. But this is what I'm trying to teach you how to do. Proverbs 28 and verse 13. So after you've acknowledged it and you've confessed it, then you want to forsake it. Proverbs 28:13, he that covereth his sin shall not prosper, but whoso confesseth and forsaketh them shall have mercy. So you don't want to only confess it, but you want to forsake it. And that's just to tell the Lord, I'm done with this thing. Tell yourself, I'm done with this stuff. I hate it when I do that, and I'm not doing this anymore. I'm forsaking this sin. And that's what you want to do. You want to tell the Lord that you'll do it no more. Now, this is the scary one. This is the one where you're like, okay, when I do this, now I've got to get serious about it. Because if you say, I forsake it, I'm not going to do it anymore, and you're just telling yourself that, that's one thing. But whenever you tell the Lord, I'm not going to be easily provoked anymore, that's whenever things get serious, because then you realize, oh boy, if I just go out there and flippantly just not even pay any attention to what I told the Lord, He's going to be mad and I'm going to be in real big trouble. Now, if I mess up and it was just inadvertent and I didn't do it on purpose, I'll do the whole thing over again. That's one thing. But boy, if you tell the Lord you're not going to do it and then you just go out there and do it anyway and you don't even give two thoughts to the oath you just made, you're going to be in trouble. But I'll tell you what, this is how you get over it. It's like an accountability partner. It's like God is your accountability partner. You tell God, I'm not going to do this anymore, and Lord, I want you to pay attention. I want you to check in with me once in a while and make sure I'm not doing this. And you'll get over it. Job 34 and verse 32. Job 34 and verse 32. See, a lot of people won't do this step, though. They won't tell the Lord, I will do it no more, because they're like, oh, what if I mess up? Well, I'll tell you what to do if you mess up. I hope that you'll do it. I hope that you will take the step, take the plunge, and see if the Lord doesn't give you the victory. Job 34, 32. Job says, that which I see not, teach thou me. If I have done iniquity, I will do it no more. Job says, if I don't see it, teach it to me. You ever pray that? You should. Lord, show me my secret sins. Show me my faults. Pray for patience. God may allow you to get married. Give you a chance to become more patient, right? Maybe that's why I found a wife. Jason was praying for patience for me all those years. Then I found a wife. And it's not her fault. It's my fault. You know, it's my fault. If I get irritated, it's my fault. That's what I've been telling you. You can't blame it on anybody else. I'm not blaming it on her. It's my fault when I get irritated. If I have done iniquity, I will do no more, Job said. Job says, if I've done this sin, you show me a sin that I'm doing, and if I've done it, I won't do it anymore. He's telling the Lord, he's putting himself out there, that I'm not going to do this anymore, Lord. I'm not going to get easily provoked anymore. And if you do this, this will help you to control your tongue and your wrath. Look at Psalm 39, 1 through 3. Psalm 39, 1 through 3. David said, I said I will take heed to my ways, that I sin not with my tongue. I will keep my mouth with a bridle while the wicked is before me. You know what David's doing here? He's doing what I've been trying to teach us to do for the last two Sundays. I'm going to keep my mouth with a bridle. I'm not going to be easily provoked. I'm not going to start lipping off whenever I get irritated with anybody, even the wicked. Now look what he says here. I'll take heed unto my ways that I sin not with my tongue. I will keep my mouth with a bridle. He's telling the Lord, I'm going to do this. And then look what he says in the next verse. I was dumb with silence. I held my peace, even from good, and my sorrow was stirred. It looked like it worked, didn't it? I'm going to keep my tongue, he says. And I was dumb, and I was silent, and I held my peace. The Lord gave him the grace to do it, right? Then look at verse 3. My heart was hot within me. While I was musing, the fire burned. Then spake I with my tongue. That's okay. David considered it. He was not soon angry. There was a legitimate provocation. His heart's hot within him. Then he muses about it. He thinks about it. The fire burns. He realizes, you know what? This is something that I should be mad about. Then spake I with my tongue. That's how you do it, just like David did. Now, a lot of times, if you sit back and you think about it, and you're going to realize, no, this is not the time to get angry, especially when it's over something trivial. So give it a thought, and I'm going to get into that. I'm getting ahead of myself, how you catch yourself. Number 5 is ask God for help to overcome your sin of being soon angry. Look at Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 15. You see, you're not going to be able to do this on your own. Anybody that's ever tried knows it's pretty hard. It's really hard to have control over your spirit. You got to ask the Lord for help. Hebrews 4:15 through 16. It says, "For we have not an high priest which cannot be touched with the feeling of our infirmities, but was in all points tempted like as we are, yet without sin." You see, Jesus was provoked, was he not? I mean, men provoked him. They tried to provoke him. But yet we saw that he did not revile when he was reviled. He did not threaten whenever he was persecuted. He's been there. You can go to Jesus and you can say, "Jesus, I'm having a real hard time with being easily provoked here. The littlest things just seem to irritate me and set me off." And Jesus can say, "You know what? I remember when those little things were trying to irritate me too. I remember what that was like, and I'm going to give you help." And he will. Verse 16, "Let us therefore come boldly under the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need." Go to him boldly. Say, "Lord, you've been here. You conquered this. You know how to do this. Give me grace and help me to do it too." And he will do it. Number 6 is stop making excuses. That's what you've got to do. And maybe that should have been number 2. I don't know. But anyway, stop making the excuses. Nobody makes you provoked. You choose to be provoked. You realize that, don't you? Nobody can make you provoked. You can just be cool, calm, and collected when somebody's trying to get you irritated. You don't have to be provoked. Now, you're going to have to train yourself because you're going to have a natural inclination. You're going to want to get angry, and you have to stop yourself. But it is a choice. Sin, in general, is a choice. Look at Isaiah 65 and verse 12. It's not like, you know, you're just a robot on a string or a puppet on a string and you've got to sin because somebody's making you. You know, the old excuse, "The devil made me do it," isn't true. The devil didn't make you do it. He tempted you to do it maybe, but he didn't make you do it. Isaiah 65 and verse 12. It says, "Therefore I will number you to the sword, and ye shall all bow down to the slaughter, because when I called, ye did not answer. When I spake, ye did not hear, but did evil before mine eyes, and did choose that wherein I delighted not." God says, "You chose to do evil. You chose to do what I delighted not." It is a choice. Now, it may seem like a reflex, but it actually is a choice. When you get easily provoked, you have chosen to allow yourself to be provoked. The excuse, "He made me so mad," or "She irritates me so badly," just doesn't work. It's not going to work with God. Don't make the excuse. Especially when you go to the Lord and you ask Him for forgiveness because I've been provoked by somebody, and then you say, "But Lord, He made me so mad." Just start over. Because that is not a confession of sin. That's an excuse. You cannot say, "He made me so mad." Don't allow yourself to say that to yourself. I've had to do that. Don't allow yourself. Do not make an excuse, even in your own mind, to yourself. Don't justify what you've done. Number 7 is learn to catch yourself as soon as you feel the urge to be provoked and flee that lust as soon as it happens. We've been to this verse before. Look at 2 Timothy 2 and verse 22. This is a very good application of it. 2 Timothy 2 and verse 22. The Lord tells Timothy, a young preacher like me, "Flee also youthful lusts, but follow after righteousness, faith, charity, peace, with them that call on the Lord out of a pure heart." As I've taught you before, the youthful lust, the youthful is an adjective describing the lust. Flee the youthful lust. When the lust is in its youth, when the lust is brand new. So your boss, your husband, your wife, your brother, whatever, somebody does something that you feel the urge to be angry. There's your lust to be easily provoked. Flee the youthful lust. As soon as it happens, stop yourself. Say, "No, I'm not going to do this." Take a breath, and when you do that, whenever you start making a habit out of it, eventually, it will become a habit. It'll become a way of life, and you won't be easily provoked. But it's going to take time. It's going to take practice. There's no doubt about it. It's not going to happen overnight. If you go through these steps when you go home today, you're probably not going to come back even next Sunday saying, well, I've licked this habit. I was not provoked one time this week. Probably not. Old habits die hard, remember. Number eight, we've got two more. Number eight, when you fall and you lose control of your spirit, repeat the process. So I know what some of you are thinking. Okay, what's going to happen when I blow it? Okay, so I'm going to do all these things you said to do, Pastor. I'm even going to do that hard one, and I'm going to tell God that I'm not going to do this anymore. But then what happens when I blow it? What happens when I get irritated? When I go home and the kids spill red Kool-Aid all over the white carpet or something, and I am tempted to get really angry. What do you do? Well, you pick yourself up, you dust yourself off, and you try again. Look at Proverbs 24 and verse 16. You just start over again. You repeat the process. You see, the thing is about a just man is that he will fall, but he'll get back up again. Proverbs 24 and verse 16 says, "For a just man falleth seven times and riseth up again, but the wicked shall fall into mischief." You see, the wicked fall into mischief and they just don't get back up again. They just continue in the mischief. But the just man, seven times he'll fall and he'll get back up again. It may take you seven times. It may take you more than seven times. Jesus said, "How many times has my brother sinned against me and I forgive him?" Jesus said, 70 times seven. Now that guy that sinned against you, he's probably gone back to the Lord 489 times and said, "Lord, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have done that. Please forgive." You know, it may take a while. But you don't go into it thinking, okay, well, I know I'm going to blow it, so I'm just not going to try that hard. No, no, you take this seriously. God says he hath no pleasure in fools. When thou vowest a vow unto God, defer not to pay. For he hath no pleasure in fools. Ecclesiastes chapter 5. Look at Psalm 37, 23. Psalm 37, 23 through 24. And by the way, these steps that I've given you here in the last part of this sermon, these work with any sin. This is not just being easily provoked. This works with any of them. And it does work. I've done it before, and it does work. Psalm 37, 23 through 24 says, "The steps of a good man are ordered by the Lord, and he delighteth in his way." Look at this. "Though he fall, he shall not be utterly cast down, for the Lord upholdeth him with his hand." The Lord orders the steps of a good man, and though a good man will fall, God will catch him. So you go home, and you go back through this outline, you do these steps, you tell the Lord, "I'm not going to do this anymore," you forsake your sin, you stop making excuses, you learn to catch yourself, and a provocation comes along, and you just lose it, and you get irritated, and you get mad, you get soon angry. And just when you're falling flat on your face, and you're going to have a great big bloody nose, the Lord holds his hand out, and he catches you, and he said, "All right, let's do this again," and he picks you back up again. "Though he fall, he shall not be utterly cast down, for the Lord upholdeth him with his hand." This is going to be a process, and it's going to take time to learn. Proverbs 4 and verse 18 says, "The path of the just is as the shining light that shineth more and more unto the perfect day." That's the Christian walk. The thing is, you're not going to lick this habit the first time, right? Just like you're not going to be able to drive from here over to St. Paul with as far as your headlights shine out ahead of you, right? The headlights keep shining. The further you go, the more it keeps shining. When you do these things and you rely on the Lord, your path is like the path of the just. It shines more and more into the perfect day, and eventually you get to the point where you will have licked the habit. And once in a while it'll come back and you'll have to do it again. But things will get easier for you. Now let me just quickly review the points that I made, and I mean really quickly, and then I've got one more parting thought for you. So why do we get easily provoked? We got seven reasons. Pride, weakness of character. That's whenever you get real mad and try to shout somebody down before they can show you why you're wrong. Selfishness, spoiledness, unthankfulness and ungratefulness, unmercifulness, and lack of love and love, compassion, and respect for people. If we get those things, those seven things under control, then the rest of this stuff will fall into place much, much more easily. And then the steps to overcome being easily provoked. Admit that you have a problem with it first. Acknowledge your sin. Confess that sin to God and get specific about it. Forsake that sin. Tell yourself, I'm not doing it anymore. Then tell God you're not doing it anymore. Ask God to help you to overcome your sin of being soon angry. Stop making excuses about it. Stop saying, he made me so mad, she made me so irritated. That doesn't work. Learn to catch yourself as soon as you feel the urge to be provoked and flee that youthful lust. When you fall, get back up and try again. Repeat the process over. And recognize that it's going to take a while to overcome it. Now, I want to leave you with one parting thought. There is one thing that we are allowed to be easily provoked to, and that is to good works. Look at Hebrews 10 and verse 24. Hebrews 10 and verse 24. So if you want to be easily provoked, if you still just love the feeling of it, well, okay, you can be easily provoked in this one thing. All the pastor will have to do is just mention one little thing to you, and instantly you're provoked to do good works. I just can't control myself. I just feel this urge to do good works every time the pastor utters a word from the Bible. That's okay with me. You can be easily provoked if that's what you want to do. Hebrews 10 and verse 24. And let us consider one another to provoke unto love and to good works. So we can provoke each other to love and to good works. Not to being soon angry, but to love and good works. And I hope that this sermon has done just that.